to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
Imagine you've been doing research on the possibility of revolution in Egypt, and you've just published a paper asking why revolutions in Egypt have failed, and then 2 weeks after publication, boom, revolution. That's the situation Hazem Kandil found himself in these past few months. And in this episode, Kandil, who is a PhD candidate in the UCLA Sociology Department, talks with Sanan Arinsu about the causes and consequences of revolution in Egypt and how sociology can help us better understand what happened and is happening still. This interview was recorded in mid-April, so some of the talk about current developments may be a little dated, so sorry about that. But stay tuned for an insightful interview with Hazem Kandil.
So Hazem, thanks for coming on the Office Hours podcast.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be given this opportunity to share my ideas.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'll start with your recent articles. Your recent article published in Theory and Society got quite a bit of attention, thanks to its timing as well as theoretical and analytical insights.
Well, okay, I wish I can say that I timed the publication of my article to in the same month of the revolution. It worked really well, but I think that in my article, some of the insights I provide can help us understand better the prospects of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So I believe in general that the institutional approach to the sociology of revolution, which is the approach that I take, was on the right track, and this is what I try to express in my article, by underlining the fact that a regime cannot be overthrown as long as the coercive organs remain willing and able to support it. Now, the recent Arab revolts makes this very obvious. If we look at the position of Tunisia and Egypt, it was a position where the military abandoned the regime. And if we look at the case of Libya and Syria and Yemen and Bahrain and others, it's a case where the military did not abandon the regime and it turned ugly over there. So this, the importance of the coercive organs in allowing revolutions to reach their conclusion, I think, is very important. The point of my article was that you cannot conquer regimes from below by stealth, that they will see you coming and they will stop you. Now, after the revolutions, I think what is missing in this approach is that it assumed that infighting within the ruling bloc, usually as a result of war, as in the case of Russia, or financial crisis, as in the case of France, precedes mass revolts. You know, this infighting within the ruling bloc signals to the masses that the regime is breaking up, and this might be the right time to challenge it. What is so surprising about the Arab revolts is that the people were, in my view, heroic enough to take to the streets without really knowing what they were up against. They dared to challenge their regimes, although on the surface, these regimes appeared strong and united. How did this happen? I think this is one of the things that we need to investigate. But while I think that the institutional approach, which is, again, the one I take, has this aspect to remedy the attitude of the people themselves, I think that other approaches need a far-reaching re-evaluation. And these are some of the approaches that I was criticizing in my article, the cultural approach and the social movement approach. So, for example, we have the culture school that has for decades been defending a host of different and, you know, usually contradictory assumptions about Muslim societies. These societies were either too passive, obedient to authority, deterministic, or they were too violent, irrational, obsessed with foreign enemies, that they did not value freedom, that they were too intolerant to work with, you know, within a united front. I think this whole edifice, of course, was shaken to the core by the revolts, and it has to be revised. Also, the social movement theory approach, which focused too much on, you know, organization building, cultural framing, resource mobilization, political opportunity. Again, one look at most of the revolutions around us today shows that none of this was really relevant. And so my article was trying to expose the limitations of these cultural and social movement approaches. So I was not criticizing Gramsci's doctrine itself, but I was criticizing a certain reading of it that focused on social and culture transformations and depreciated the value of frontal assaults.
So maybe we should go back to Muslim Brotherhood and think about their role in the revolution. So you argue that cultural and social movement approach didn't bring about the revolution. So mm-hmm. in a sense, the events like mm-hmm. prove your point, because these events were not triggered or started by the Muslim Brotherhood. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, this peaceful nature of the events and the solidarity of participants from different segments of society signals a form of shared cultural and social mindset that might be an outcome of a long-lasting hegemonic struggle against the regime. So what would your response be on this? And maybe you may take some time to talk about Muslim Brotherhood and their recent relevance in Egypt, especially during and after the revolution, and if there is any change in this duration.
Well, in the conclusion of my article, I think I stated clearly that the Muslim Brothers have done a good job during the past decades to spread culture hegemony, and that I said that this will be only of great value to them if they can come to power by other means, which is exactly what happened. Although the cultural frames and the organization of the brothers themselves contributed very little to the revolt, now that the regime has been overthrown, they might have a chance to capitalize on what they have been building on for years. Now, of course, that being said, I also must point out to the fact that the success of the revolt, to the extent that it was successful, presents the Muslim Brothers with three important challenges that they will need to deal with. The first challenge is what happened during the revolt itself. So I think that despite their efforts over the past decades, religion did not play a vital role in the demonstrations. The demands were freedom and justice. They were not the application of the Sharia. The participants in the demonstrations represented all Egyptians, regardless of their religion or piety. The culture itself within Tahrir Square reflected that diversity. We can see that songs and jokes were as important as religious sermons and political speeches. So the first challenge is that it was obvious that after all this cultural hegemony, religion was not the main player in the revolt itself. The second challenge is the emerging democracy that we hope will come out of this revolt. I think this will substantially weaken the brothers. The obedience of their rank and file primarily had to do with the fact that they were working underground, that they needed solidarity because they were on the receiving end of state coercion. Their zeal was fueled by the martyrdom halo surrounding them. You know, hundreds of their members were detained, tortured, or executed, and so on. The social services that they provided were so valuable to the people because you basically had a corrupt state that cared little about its citizens. Now, all this will change. In a democracy, in a well-functioning state, there is no reason for martyrdom. There is no real value for, you know, non-governmental social aid and so on. A third factor, which I think is a very important challenge, and I'm not really sure that it has received enough attention from international observers, is the return of independence to Al-Azhar University. Now, of course, you know that for centuries, Al-Azhar scholars had the authority and the scientific credentials to speak in the name of Islam. And what they said had great weight in the Muslim street. Now, after the Azhar has been tied to the state since the early 60s, lay activists, like people in the Brotherhood, started acquiring some authority in representing Islam because the Azhar was discredited by its ties to the state. Now that the Azhar is regaining its independence, I think the moral and the religious authority of the Muslim Brotherhood will be severely challenged. Not just the Muslim Brotherhood, but also other religious groups that do not have the credentials and the recognition to be, you know, speaking or interpreting Islam. We have already seen some signs of this. Al-Azhar is presenting a project for it to regain its independence. We have also seen that the Muslim Brotherhood is fragmenting after the revolt. There are already two factions that are breaking away and forming their own bodies. Islamist movements in general have become, you know, more dynamic. They're producing more parties and more movements. And so we see a case of fragmentation. But we also see that religion in general remains important to Egyptians. We have seen that specifically in the last referendum, which was the first democratic referendum in Egypt. So in other words, what I mean by that is that Islam has been and will remain a constant in the lives of most Egyptians. But Islamist movements, including the Muslim Brothers, are variable. Their ideologies are variable. And so if you combine these two factors, that Islam is constant and Islamism is variable, then we can conclude that non-Islamist parties have nothing to fear of organized Islamist groups if they do nothing to offend or undermine Islam.
So just a clarification question. With the rise of Azhar in Egypt,
yes.
Do you predict a centralization of religious authority?
Al-Azhar's religious authority has not ever depended on centralization. It has depended on credentials. So what happens usually is that if you get the scientific credentials to become an Islamic scholar, then you start having the right to interpreting religion. What usually happened within Al-Azhar is that there was a wide array of opinions within Al-Azhar itself, representing the different schools of thought, the different sects. Some are more conservative, some are more liberal. There were many differences, there were many disputes within Al-Azhar itself. And people would choose any opinion along that wide continuum. But all of them shared one thing, which is that they had the education and that they had the credentials to be able to present scientific interpretations of Islam. Now, when Azhar in general has been tied to the state, what happened is that this diversification itself was limited. The Sheikh of Al-Azhar became the sole voice of it, and this sole voice was too close to the state and its interests. And in that case, you had lay intellectuals, the people who have graduated from business or engineering or so on, joining movements like the Muslim Brothers or other Islamist movements, speaking in the name of Islam, making all these different claims. And people would believe them and people would follow them because the only source of, you know, real authority was not there anymore. So hopefully speaking, once Al-Azhar regains its independence, and more importantly, regains the same diversity within it, then I think it will be able to represent Islam in a more credible way, and it will have more authority within the street. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I see. I see better now. I mean, you're talking a change towards a diversity rather than a centralization of religious authority.
I think, again, it's like academia in the West. You know, getting a PhD or being appointed as a professor gives you certain kind of weight to discuss certain scholarly issues. Now, of course, we have many different schools and many different approaches as we have different, you know, professors or scholars. But at the same time, this is different than people who don't have that scientific credentials speaking scientifically about some of the social issues and so on.
Okay. Well, going back to the revolution again, can we say the revolution in Egypt is over now? Or put it more generally and theoretically, when does a revolution end? Can we talk about different phases of a revolution? And what is the current situation in Egypt now? I mean, who are different actors, and are they different than the ones in Tahrir Square?
I don't believe that there are standard stages in any revolution, as early scholars of revolution argued. But certainly the overthrow of the old political elite is only the first step. It is usually followed by eradicating the old regime as a whole, or purging as many of its members as possible, and then building a new regime. I'm not sure how far Egypt could advance in that process, considering the absence of a very important player, a revolutionary movement. Now, this is one thing we did not have in Egypt. What happened in Egypt was that an enormous and persistent popular uprising provided an opportunity for the military to move against its other two partners in the ruling bloc. That is the political apparatus and the security establishment. Now, I think any understanding of the Egyptian revolution has to start from these two givens. First, that while the military had serious misgivings against the political and security institutions, it could not have moved against them unless an opportunity presented itself. And so I think the army needed the popular uprising. But at the same time, we have to understand that the popular uprising was vital for the military, but it could not have succeeded if the military did not decide to back it up. So I think really the outcome depends on the balance that can be reached between the people's demands and the military's demands. So far, I don't think that these demands are mutually exclusive. The military seems to want greater autonomy and a greater capacity to project regional power. And the people, with all their different groups, all want democracy. If we examine current democracies, we can see that these two can go together, albeit with some frictions. And so I think what is happening right now is that we are trying to negotiate this balance where the military would achieve some of its demands, but at the same time, it will allow the people to achieve the kind of democracy that they have been striving for.
Well, I think when I asked this question, I was concerned about this. When the heat in the square is gone, mm-hmm. there's always this risk of this leaderless, spontaneous spirit will be hijacked by more established actors, such as the military or some portions of old governmental elite or some other circles. Do you think that it is still possible?
Well, I think this is a good question. I have three short responses. First, I don't think that the heat has gone yet. I mean, last Friday, which is only four yeah. days ago, mm-hmm. We had almost over a million people in the square. Now we have thousands of people still there. And so I think the heat is not gone yet. That's the first thing. The second thing, I agree with you that if we have a more organized group, that they will be able to capitalize on the you know results of the uprising. The real organized group is the military, and I think the military, like I just mentioned, do not have an anti-democratic agenda. They want to increase their autonomy and their power, but they don't want necessarily to go back to an authoritarian regime. Now, when it comes to other groups, I honestly don't think that other groups are organized at all. People talk about the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist movements, and I think what I was trying to express in my article was the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood was organized as a culture movement, not as a political movement. Mm-hmm. And when we look at it right now, we see that every movement, Islamist and non-Islamist, are in complete disarray. So the Muslim Brotherhood in particular is thinking about establishing a new party. There are differences about what the program of this party is. There are differences about who will lead the party. There are two factions that already declared that they will remove themselves from the Brotherhood and form other different parties. There are serious controversies about the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and the new party it establishes. Will it direct it? Will it be just, you know, parallel to it? What kind of relationship can it have? So I think that in reality, no one is organized enough to be able to capitalize or hijack the popular uprising, as, for example, happened in Iran. I think that the uprising surprised everyone, and even liberals, leftists, workers, Islamists, they have not seen it coming, and they have not prepared themselves for the new stage where they can actually compete in a democracy.
Well, it's a good transition point to my next question. Mm-hmm. I have actually a couple of questions about the broader implication of the Egyptian revolution and the idea of collective direct action. So, for example, in a recent article, French thinker Alain Badiou draws attention to the importance of collective street action by saying, I'm quoting, "What the Tunisian and Egyptian people remind us is that the only action appropriate to the sentiment of Skendeli's takeover by state power is mass uprising." Others also put emphasis on the leaderless, agendaless, spontaneous nature of these movements in the Middle East, and by pointing at similar uprisings of the last decade, such as those of Argentina and the Battle of Seattle, for example. So the one question is, do Middle East uprisings signal a new revolution, form of revolution? And if yes, is it possible to define this new type? And a related question would be about this domino effect of the uprisings. Some observers are quite optimistic that recent events will inspire sooner or later similar forms of collective action, not only in the Middle East, but also across the world. For example, Hart and Negri hope that, I'm quoting, leaderless Middle East uprisings can inspire freedom movements as Latin America did before. Another analogy that people talk about a lot, especially in the US, this similarity between the Cairo moment and Wisconsin-Madison moments. People suggest that the uprisings in Egypt inspired, if not triggered, the long-lasting protest against Governor Walker's anti-union legislation. So do you think these are far-fetched comments that has no significant basis? Or the uprisings in the Middle East do really stand for something that is new and global?
We cannot go as far as claiming that this is an entirely new type of revolution, but it certainly has new elements, in my view. The most important for sociologists is the ability of people to organize on site as the revolt itself progresses, mm-hmm. rather than beforehand. Mm-hmm. And this makes a huge difference. Scholars of the state had pointed out that the advancement in the state's surveillance and coercive capacities have rendered revolution impossible because they allow regimes to preempt revolts through monitoring revolutionary movements and disrupting their work. But what happens if revolts begin first, then organize later, organize along the way? It becomes really difficult for states to repress them unless, you know, they develop mind-reading abilities. And this new capacity to organize, which probably relates to new communication technologies, will be likely replicated elsewhere. And this is the domino effect, you know, the element of the people being able to start something and then organizing it along the way. This element will probably be replicated in other places. Of course, that being said, the nature and the results of these uprisings will be very different. Certainly, you know, they will differ in terms of the context. Something like, you know, a labor strike in Wisconsin will be very different than a popular uprising in Egypt. And at the same time, like the anti-globalization, you know, mass movements like in Seattle and so on will be different, like in a case like in Libya. But I think that element of that enables people to organize on site will be important and will have an element in inspiring more uprisings. That does not mean, however, that they will be successful. I think even if governments cannot predict and prevent uprisings, they do not have to submit to them. They could ignore them or repress them by force. And here again, I think this is where the institutional approach is very important, which because it focuses not only on what makes an uprising possible, but on the forces that are rallied against it. So certainly we can see that in the case of Libya, this ability to organize was not very successful so far because it has been brutally repressed by the military. And so I do believe that we should have some more hope now in people power. But at the same time, we cannot ignore the forces that are rallied against them. Most importantly, the coercive organs of the state.
So, what makes the recent uprisings and revolutions different is this spontaneity element in them and their ability to organize on site. So, in that sense, would you like to talk about the impact of social media, Facebook and Twitter, as something that makes difference in these revolutions? And would you predict something, the importance of these social media to persist in such events?
Well, I would like to differentiate between spontaneity and ability to organize on site. I think we had spontaneity before, but the reason that it was not very successful is that people could not organize on site. So now what we have in addition to spontaneity is the ability to organize as the revolt goes along. Now, having made that distinction, I think that social media plays an important role. I do not tend to exaggerate their role as some observers do now, but I think that different kinds of communication technologies are important. So Facebook and Twitter are important, blogs are important, but also cell phones are important. And at the same time, in the case of the Arab world in particular, things like satellite television was very important. Mm-hmm. I would certainly have to say that channels like Al Jazeera and other satellite channels, and even Egyptian independent satellite channels, were crucial because they are the ones that kept people aware of what was going on in other parts of the country and what the state was preparing against them. Now, these were things that could not have been covered by regular activists using Twitter or Facebook or so on. You had to have professional news members and professional reporters being able to get crucial information in time for the demonstrators. And at the same time, you had talk shows that were very important in Egypt and in other Arab revolts that brought many of the important players to the talk shows and discussed with them matters of strategy, what should happen, what were the mistakes of the day, and how things can be different the other day. This kind of forum, again, is much more interactive than Facebook or Twitter would allow. So I think in general, I would say that communication technologies are important and that Facebook and Twitter and so on are only one element in these new communication technologies.
Oh, thank you. I mean, these were relatively uncovered aspects mm-hmm. of the revolution and on-site organization. I have a more Middle East centered question.
Okay.
Some commentators, especially in the West and here in the US, celebrated the events as the awakening of the Arab nation, a first instance of resurrection through which peoples of the region showed the world their courage and love for freedom, etc. To what extent is this an accurate depiction? Has the region not hosted many collective actions of a similar scale in the past and even more recently? What is this trope of Arab Street in the Western press, and how is it changing actually?
Well, I think that there certainly has been a general fear of the Arab Street and what it could do once it decides it had enough. We have seen that a lot of commentators and politicians. But many scholars, however, have dismissed these warnings about the Arab Street because they saw Arab citizens as either too indifferent or too hot-headed to be effective. There were, of course, a lot of other mass uprisings, not on that same scale. But again, observers saw that, you know, people were too hot-headed, too angry to be effective politically. And so they dismissed that. These revolts give new weight and credence to the Arab Street. And I think that analysts are now wondering if we have a new type of Arab citizen on our hand, a kind of citizen who is brave, calculating and unrelenting at the same time. I think that now this Arab Street as a variable should enter into the political calculations of many you know, politicians. Although I'm not really sure how far we as sociologists can study the kind of specific elements of what makes that Arab street or so on.
I see. Well, the next question is kind of more personal one, because it's about where I study, and that is Turkey. After the uprising was successful and Mubarak stepped down, people have started to search for a possible models for future Egypt. Many observers, including, for example, Tariq Ramadan, suggested that Turkey is a secular democracy governed by, well, ex-Islamists, I would say, might be a good example that Egypt could follow. Even some Brotherhood representatives that I've seen mentioned Turkish democracy as an inspiring example. So what is your take on such comments? Well, have you encountered them, or is it just me reading too many Turkish newspapers maybe? And are these comments, if you have read them, not missing the economical motive behind the Egyptian revolution by just underlining the need for a liberal democracy?
Well, I don't know whether you know that or not, but this is a personal question for me as well, because my dissertation compares Egypt, Turkey, and Iran. So this was the big question on my mind, comparisons between Egypt and Turkey. And it's a difficult question, but, my thoughts so far are divided between the differences between Egypt and Turkey and the similarities. Now, in terms of differences, we have many. I mean, we can make a long list, not least of which is the radical secularization of Turkey under Ataturk, as opposed to the great respect that the Egyptian military has shown so far for Islam and religion and so on. Of course, there are the geopolitical aspects, the Turkey being at the heart of the Cold War, a member of NATO, not the same situation for Egypt. Mm-hmm. The economic, the economic prosperity in Turkey, which is, again, not the same case in Egypt. These are important differences. But I think what observers are really pointing at is two things. And these two things are not necessarily similarities, but you can say like best case scenarios for many observers. The first is because of the military's crucial role in the success of the revolt in Egypt, people are expecting that it will probably play a more active role in politics, just like the case is with Turkey. Although from my own viewpoint, I think that if the military in Egypt plays a role, it will be focused on national security rather than domestic and cultural politics, like in the case in Turkey. The second thing that people are hoping for is that Islamists in Egypt will probably be as moderate and pragmatic as their counterparts in Turkey. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily agree with you on calling them ex-Islamists, but I would certainly agree with you that they are a new breed of Islamists that are moderate, tolerant, pragmatic, democratic, and so on. Whatever they are certainly a model that many people hope that Islamists in Egypt will be able to follow. So in these two cases, the role of the military in the political system and the moderate pragmatic Islamism, these are the two things where people are hoping that Egypt will stir towards. And I don't think it's far-fetched to think that Egypt is already being stirred towards that direction.
Yeah. Well, I should definitely ask a labor-related question. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not well covered in the media, but one important component of the revolution has been, well, as far as I know, the labor struggle. I'm thinking of strikes and factory occupations, etc., and probably some of them are still going on. Is there any sign that revolution would have any impact on relations of production in Egypt?
Well, labor strikes have been localized and only economic-oriented in the decade that preceded the revolt, as well as in the weeks that followed it. I think this is mainly has to do with the policies of the old authoritarian regime, which has, on the one hand, severe war relations between workers on the national level and between them and leftist activists. And on the other hand, has been responding piecemeal to workers' economic demands to reassure foreign investors that it's safe to invest in Egypt. And so we have a situation where in the last decade, you had almost more than a million people involved on and off in different places with different numbers in some kind of labor disputes. But what we've seen that these disputes were, again, very focused on economic needs. They made no political or national demands. And this is what we've seen during the revolt as well. The labor strikes started really late, only 4 days, I think, before the president stepped down. And from that time on, even after the president stepped down and, you know, the regime has somehow crumbled, the workers have not had the organization or the imagination to make national political demands. And this is why today many of the people who were organizing the demonstrations and the uprising have problems with the laborers, because they what they see is that they're only trying to disrupt production. They are not making demands that can be taken up by a wider national front. And this is why, I don't know whether you've been following or not, the Prime Minister has been trying to issue this law to differentiate between national political demonstrations, asking for national political rights, and between labor strikes that have no political demands, that are just focused on acquiring as much economically as they can get, and in trying to encourage the first and outlaw the second. So, I mean, I do not think that the labor strikes have been up to the historic moment that we've been facing. But I don't blame them, because this is all they have been doing in the past years under the authoritarian regime.
And a final question about Libya. Well, although you referred to it several times throughout the interview, well, I want to ask about the international involvement. Well, do you think the military intervention will have a negative impact on the revolution wave in the region in general?
Well, I think this depends on two factors, really. First, in terms of military analysis, I have published an article a few months ago highlighting the limited effectiveness of airstrikes in overthrowing regimes. So, of course, I believe if NATO uses ground troops, this will completely delegitimize the revolt. So this is not what I'm suggesting. But I think that the effectiveness of this NATO-led campaign from a military standpoint will depend on how well they can coordinate with the rebels on the ground. If the rebels have enough training and competence to guide the bombers to the right targets and to follow up with ground attacks, then it might be a successful operation militarily, and it might be able to overthrow the regime. This will bring us to the other, you know, aspect of it, which is the political aspect. I think politically speaking, if the Libyan regime is overthrown, we all have to wait and see how NATO governments will deal with the new regime. If they try to transform the new rulers into puppets implementing Western agendas, then the whole revolution, of course, will become thoroughly discredited. But if they truly believe that a more democratic and accountable regime will by and of itself contribute to the stability and prosperity of the country, and they decide to just let it be, then they would certainly set a precedent for how world powers could contribute positively to democratic change. Of course, I have to add here that, you know, knowing the ways of the world and the narrowness and short-sightedness that have characterized Western strategies in the last few years, I'm not really sure that they will make the right choice here.
Thank you, Azim. Well, these were the questions I have for you today. Do you have anything to add?
No, I want to thank you for providing me again with this opportunity to, present some of my ideas. I hope that I answered your questions in a way that was, you know, informative and insightful.
Well, definitely. It was such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for joining us and sharing your insights. And, well, good luck with your research.
Okay. Thank you, Sina.
That's all for Office Hours this week. Keep your eye on our feed, though, because we've got some great stuff in the queue. And if you like what you hear on Office Hours, tell your friends, your coworkers, your family, your students, your teachers, that awkward guy on the bus who always tries to talk to you, now you know what to talk about. Thanks, as always, to the TSP team at Minnesota and to the College of Liberal Arts Office of Information Technology at the U of M. See you again soon. Today.